The House Interim Committee on Human Services on today, January 19th, 2011. And we've changed the agenda order. LC 108 will be discussed first, and then the recommendations of the CASA Task Force and LC 96. With that, I'm opening an informational hearing on LC 108. We have invited testimony Dr. Jeff Murata, Representative Bill Kennemer. Is Larry Nieswander here? Oh, hi, Larry. Come on up. And Bill Perry? Good. Can you just pull up? Sure. Can everybody just pull up? Thanks. Oh. This is a committee. Oh, yes, thank you.
Chairs and members of the committee, just a brief preliminary background on LC 108 relating to public harms associated with lottery games. It permits the director of the Oregon State Lottery to require the adoption of a policy by the Oregon State Lottery Commission of mitigating public harms associated with lottery games, marketing practices, and retail regulations, and it establishes the content of such a policy.
Thank you. It is Dr. Kennemer. Dr. Representative Kennemer, you want to start?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about a topic that's of, I think, concern to all of us. Co-Chair Tomei and I and others have been working on some thoughts about dealing with the lottery. It's an interesting piece for me. As you know, I served in the Senate back in the 80s and 90s, and that's when we first began the lottery in Oregon and was involved with that. And I remember when I came in 2009, I was concerned because at that point there was some advertising on TV of video poker, which there had been an agreement previously that we wouldn't do. And that was terminated, and I appreciate that. And, of course, we have had a change in leadership, too. So I think that's under control. But the issue is that video poker is extremely addictive. And when we were looking at this in 2009, the estimate was that around 55,000 individuals in Oregon are addicted to Oregon State Video Lottery. You know, there are efforts to upgrade that, and you'll hear maybe some other testimony, but it may be more in the nature of 65,000 now. That's a lot of individuals. And part of the issue is that under the lottery's mission, one of their goals is to maximize profit. And in these days when we're money hungry, that's not entirely a bad thing. And frankly, I think video poker is a big improvement over gray games and illegal gambling. But I think the piece that's missing is a comment about concern for the public good. And as legislators, it's our job to try and help balance issues and make sure that the public good is maintained. So what we do with this draft is pretty simple. We take some language that's already existing in other lottery documents and suggest that maximizing profits should be balanced with concern for the public good. And just forgot my second point. And we codified their process of using committees to deal with some of these kinds of concerns. So it is, I think, an important step, but at this point in time, it doesn't change policies or procedures, but it does codify what they're currently doing, and I think it begins to help us focus a discussion. And with that, if there are any questions, I'd be delighted.
Any questions? Thank you.
So you mentioned the addictiveness of the poker. I understand the line games are also extremely addictive. Is that something that you worry about as well? We should worry about as well.
You know, we have an expert with us in Dr. Murata next to me, so let me defer that question really to him because I believe that to be accurate, but I'm not as up to speed on that. And I don't know if you want to answer that now or maybe ask it when he gives his testimony.
Let's hold that question for Dr. Murata. Okay, Dr. Murata, thank you for coming today. Any other questions, I'm sorry, before of Representative Kennemer? All right, thank you.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gehling, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Murata. I am the president of Problem Gambling Solutions. It's a private corporation that's designed to assist mainly governmental agencies, but also the gaming industry in developing strategies, programs, and policies to reduce gambling-related harm. My background goes back some ways in this field. I have worked with the Institute for the Study of Gambling and Commercial Gaming. I was the former manager of Problem Gambling Services at the Department of Human Services here in Oregon. And I have since worked with jurisdictions really all over the several in this country and in other countries in helping them develop policies, programs, and strategies, solutions to mitigate gambling-related harm. With this background, individuals came to me with an interest in furthering Oregon's response to reduce gambling-related harm here in the state. Oregon already has a good reputation for their programs to do so. However, there is more that can be done. And when I received this request to basically look at policies that might further our efforts, I really turned to the broader field of responsible gambling. And the first thing that came to mind was developments in the European Union. What happened in the European Union, I think, is a very interesting case. What happened there was during the structuring of the union, and it was to further their economic advantages in the global market, they broke down trade barriers between countries, and one of the resulting actions that came out of the laws was litigation from private gaming corporations that the state-owned gaming monopolies were illegal because monopolies were no longer legal within the European Union, and the private industry wanted to participate in that industry. The courts took up the issue, and what they determined was that states, in fact, could hold a monopoly because of certain virtues states had over corporations. Namely, corporations are beholden to their stakeholders. They're in the business of serving them and producing profits for them. States, on the other hand, are in the business of serving their citizens. They have a duty of care, and they are they put the welfare of their citizens above profits. And for that reason, it was decided that as long as state-operated gambling, its primary purpose was to address the unintended negative consequences related to gambling and gambling activities, states were in a position to offer gambling opportunities as a monopoly. So that made me think that of our situation here in Oregon, and we have a situation where our state-operated gambling, the Oregon State Lottery's mission is to maximize revenues commensurate with the public good. Well, this really isn't too far off from the European Union's interpretation, commensurate with the public good. What they did is they basically interpreted that to mean we need to do, the state needs to mitigate gambling-related harm, and that needs to be their primary purpose. These games are going to exist. People are going to gamble. People ask to have gambling opportunities. What type of operator do we want at the helm? So what we looked at, what some of the language tries to do here is basically interpret what that means, commensurate with the public good, because it could be interpreted very many different ways. It could be interpreted as the more money that is brought in, the more public good is created because these programs are going toward public programs. Now, the lottery has gone a step further than what is in statute, and they have interpreted that phrase, and that's to balance maximizing revenues, and I don't know if I have this phrase exactly correct, with minimizing or problem gambling, something to that nature. Now, the other thing that this bill addresses is in Section 3, and that is exactly what does that mean? What would a state operator do in order to mitigate gambling-related harm. And for that, I basically surveyed the field, and this is something I keep abreast of as the line of my work, and looked, and what I felt was kind of the best set of policies that addressed this issue was developed by the Australian Productivity Commission. The Productivity Commission is kind of equivalent to our federal government accounting office. They're an independent research and advisory body to the Australian government. And they took up this issue, and they came up with what they called a policy trilogy. And it basically addresses the items that are listed in items A through F in Section 3. So that's that was kind of the basis behind some of the language that was proposed. With that, I think I would just like to open it up to any questions that the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Murata. Representative Greenlick, did you have a question?
Oh, it's the same question I had. I'm worried about the whole question of line games and where they're going as well in the future of gambling. My sense is that they're designed using techniques that addict people specifically. I wonder if you have any comment on that.
Yeah, when the way the field generally talks about line games, or there's different phrases, but they're electronic forms of gambling. In line games, video poker, nowadays, a single terminal frequently offers a variety of games, including line games and video poker. It's no longer, it used to be video poker had been a concern here in Oregon. And now that's really been expanded to really video lottery terminals.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Harker, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think you just said that what is behind some of the language in Section 3, A through 1, A through F, is based upon work that was done in Australia. I'm as a former researcher, I'm intrigued by this statement: the policy shall include, and then jump down to E, research on harm mitigation practices and outcomes. We have to be careful about the wording that we use here. So how does the policy include research? Does the policy intended to foster research? Is the policy intended to be based upon research that has been and is being conducted, or what?
Hawker, excellent question. This is a relatively young field. It's a very exciting field to be in, but because it is young, there isn't a large body of research on what are the most effective practices. A lot of what is believed to be useful, responsible gambling strategies and practices just doesn't have a lot of evidence supporting or disqualifying it. And so what jurisdictions have frequently done is they have invested in evaluation of the various harm reduction or harm mitigation strategies. So for instance, what if there was a pause every 5 minutes and then the screen would pop up and it would say, you're down $20. Would you like to continue playing? Hit yes or hit no to continue or not to continue. Does that have any impact? We don't know. Some things that seem intuitively correct turn out not to be intuitively correct, and there's some interesting examples of that. And so the research statement is in there because we feel it's important to base both the policies and decisions going into harm mitigation strategies, but also to determine whether or not they are achieving the desired results. And without the research, we just won't be able to know that.
We can follow up on this when we have more testimony in the February session. Is that okay with you?
Works fine for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Nieswander, thank you for coming today.
Yes. Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, good morning. Larry Nieswander for the record, the director of the Oregon Lottery. I provided you with a copy of my written testimony. and we'll just speak briefly to it. As has been already testified to, the bill does direct for adoption of a comprehensive policy to mitigate the social harms associated with lottery games and lottery game practices, and then specifies what elements are required to be included in that policy, and Representative Parker picked up on one of those, and then make recommendations to how we would actually implement those strategies to mitigate harms through research and then methods to assess the effectiveness of those strategies and track progress. So just to be clear, lottery has not taken a position on this bill. It's just we do have some questions we'd like to ask and maybe some clarifications when it does come before the body that would help us to be able to assess what impact it may have on the lottery. It appears on its face to require some new activities, and if it does, it could have a fiscal impact. If it doesn't, then that would be good to get clear in the record. It also, the nature of some of those activities raise a question as to whether that lottery can legally pay for some of those activities to be done. Research might be a good example, or at least extensive research on harm mitigation. So to the extent that through the process in the committee, it can be clear what kinds of activities there are. That helps me from a legal standpoint to know what lottery can pay for or what otherwise might have to be funded through an alternative fund source. So we do take the mandate of maximizing revenue commensurate with the public good very seriously, and as Representative Kennedy spoke to and Jeff Murata, there's a number of activities that we undertake on an ongoing basis to make sure that we do that, and we have tried to be show a good faith effort in doing that. On page 2 of my testimony, there's 5 bullets there that just show you some of the things that we regularly and actively do to engage with the public, to solicit public input, and to try to be true to that dual mission of raising revenue commensurate with the public good. To Jeff's point, is there more we can do? Yes. And we do engage with activities with groups outside to solicit best practices and their recommendations. In fact, he's facilitating a group for the lottery right now on marketing strategies to look at our overall marketing strategies as well as those of the proposed arcade site that was in the media a few months ago. So, and that's an active role that we do play in staying connected with public concerns. And it's true, most adults do choose to gamble and do so responsibly, and consistent with the testimony of Representative Kennemer, we do find that 1-3% of adults meet the criteria for problem gamblers in the state of Oregon, and so we do try to do what we can to have best practices around that. In terms of the funding that we provide to the Department of Human Services, which is the statute requires a 1% allocation to treatment for DHS on a biennial basis. That's roughly $10 million a biennium. And then they operate a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week helpline. So, and the advertisements that we do put out there, you know, confirm to the citizens of Oregon that that treatment is free, confidential, effective. And so we know that's one of the avenues we do to try and make sure we're balancing that. And then beyond that, we do public information outreach within the lottery. I guess just as a technical note coming into this, I would suggest that that Section 3, Line 2 of the bill, that you consider changing that language just a little. It gives the director a little more power than I'm comfortable having. It states that essentially that the commission acts in response to the director's requests, and it actually is just quite the opposite. The director actually operates under the guidance of the commission. So. As Representative Harker picked up on, there are some new terms in here, and as Jeff spoke to, they are based on some work done in other countries, in particular Australia. And so on my testimony, I just wanted to make note that there are some new terms in there, and to that extent, they could be considered new directives. And so I would hope that in the record we could be clear about what if anything, new or different, this bill might require the lottery to do than it's already doing. Actively balancing the mission with that maximizing revenue with minimizing problem gambling. We do have some brochures and have talked and some talking points that have used that word. What that means to us and what that may mean to the legislature, you know, is what we would want to kind of fully understand. We have struck a balance. Now, is that balance the correct balance, and how would that change under this bill? So the terms mitigating the public harms are in here, code of conduct, strategies to mitigate risks, the institutional structures to protect persons, and then research. So just new terms. Those are not in our existing policies. I saw from research that Jeff provided me a couple of days ago that those are terms used in this Australian policy implementation strategy. And so I want to understand more about what those terms would mean in Oregon.
And we will, of course, have more extensive hearings on that.
So, if it's to increase regulation of lottery or modify what we do currently under lottery's policies, then I guess I would want to understand to what extent it needs to change. If it's to reduce the number of people who play the lottery or the amount of time that they play the lottery, then there are obviously implications to the fiscal and revenue to the state that we would want to just understand, as a part of that. If that's a shift that the legislature wants to make, just understand what that impact may be. I guess just to finish, to the extent that it's asked us to do more within our existing operating budget than we currently do, any additional cost might reduce the amount transferred to the state. If the activities ultimately end up, and this sometimes is a legal assessment, what lottery can pay for and what it can't pay for, if anything that we are asked to do under the bill or directed to do couldn't be funded from lottery, then we would look to an alternative fund source. If, however, it's just to merely codify our existing practices and laws that we have and what we're doing in Lottery Commission approved policy, then we might consider changing some of the wording, because some of the new wording does introduce those questions. So those are the things that we'd like to have addressed through the committee process, and I'll be available to help with that as needed, and I appreciate your time today.
We appreciate the investment you've made with the committee and with these two gentlemen. Thank you very much. Any quick questions before we move on to Mr. Perry?
I do.
Okay.
I guess the issue is, when you say, are we asking you just to do what you do now? I may not be sure what you do now, but I am sure that your predecessor's position was not based on balancing this at all. It was, and we heard testimony in this and other committees that the position of the lottery was to maximize revenue, unspoken, at any cost. And it really felt that way to us. So when you say, are you asking us to just continue doing what you're doing, I can tell you we're asking you not to continue doing what the lottery has been doing over the past few years. And maybe you can provide us some evidence that there's been a switch in the relative balance. I mean, the way to have zero effect on problem gamblers is to shut down the lottery, which I would actually favor. The way not to is to just maximize revenue. So we're asking for you to conceptually to feel somewhere in that balance between no lottery and a free-flowing lottery that does whatever it has to do to maximize revenue.
Yeah, and co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, that's a very good question. I appreciate it. We are continuing to evaluate and evolve, make sure we maintain a balance. It does take continually coming in and engaging on these conversations like this and with these advisory committees that we bring in. It also requires us to stay abreast of technology and what technology allows us to do. And we've had systems over the last few years that allow a lot more total anonymous play, and that systems of the future may give us the ability to go move away from anonymous play. To the extent that we can do that and do that under the policy guidance of the legislature, it may give us increased tools to use in the arena of problem gambling mitigation, because then you can know a little more about what the player is, what limits they want to set, monitor their activity, give them feedback when they approach those limits. And so technology hasn't allowed us to do that yet, but I would suggest to you that is one of the things that we're doing now and continuing to do as we move forward with systems and changes in machines and software in sensitivity to those issues, public gambling. And so I think the previous director did a lot too for outreach. I am trying to continue that and in many respects do what I can to increase it, but in balance with the mission.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Okay. Colleagues, we're going to have a lot more time in February to look in this issue in more depth. And I want to make sure we have time to hear from Mr. Perry. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you. For the record, Bill Perry, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm passing around some testimony, so I won't read it word for word, but I did want to give a little bit of perspective from the standpoint. Obviously, the lottery came with a ballot measure in 84. Video came along in 91. I was actually Sergeant-at-Arms on the floor in 91, so I got to witness the debate and didn't have to take a position on either side of it. But when you look at lottery, after all the components got into place, you have about an annual 4% growth pretty consistently up until about 2003. Now, I know the lottery has been blamed for a lot of the things, but I want to say that when you look at 2003, when that annual 4% growth stopped happening, and it's been all over the map, almost all of those are from things that have come from the legislature outside of line games. In 2003, I actually included the bill, which is the first portion of the handout, which added a sixth machine. I specifically recommended against it, and we did not support the bill. The lottery did not recommend it, or obviously they can't support the bill. It came from basically inside the building, and if you notice in the bill, there are whereases at the top of the bill, which you don't see very often. So it was a directive from the legislature to go to a sixth machine. It was not something that came from the industry. Now, you had a bigger than a 4% growth after that had happened. Then, when you look at 2005, oh, let me back up. As a general position, the lottery does operations and the legislature spends money. And so the industry and the lottery actually set aside the 1% for addiction treatment in the beginning inside the lottery system. And lawyers said you can't do that. The legislature advocates for it or does it. So we went to the legislature and asked for the 1%. Now, the 1%, for the most part, covers all the people seeking treatment. There was a glitch there where people were not, that were seeking treatment, were having trouble getting resources. Well, that's because in 2005, the legislature actually took about $400,000 out of that account to balance the budget towards the end of the legislative process. Once again, not advocated by the industry. And then the one other thing I want to bring out is the smoking ban. Obviously, some of you were aware of it or here when it happened. The final version of the bill we did not oppose. We had reached an agreement, and so we didn't support, didn't oppose. Now, that was the biggest hit to the lottery. The lottery, I think their recommendation was it was going to cost you between 12 to 15%. Ours was it was about 15 to 16%. And so it's just a policy choice. Do you want smoking? If you, you know, do, you get this much money. If you don't want smoking, you take this much out of the budget. I'm not saying advocating one way or another. But I added at the end the revenue impact, which I will read. Almost every jurisdiction that's ever banned smoking has lost gaming revenues. So that's, you know, the numbers may be different, but it's pretty common. And if you look at the revenue impact, it says reductions in OLCC and lottery revenues are probable and not included in this estimate. So you lost $150 million, but you didn't budget it. And so then that's when the lottery started advertising video for the first time, and it was because they knew they couldn't meet their projection. I'm not saying it's a good or bad statement, or I actually didn't think they should be advertising video on TV, but a lot of this are actions the legislature does to try to gain revenue, and the lottery is put in a box to where you give them a projection that they may not be able to meet, and they're just trying to meet that projection. And I would just argue that this bill could potentially fall into the same thing. And so if you want to basically implement measures like it had been brought up, timers on machines or whatever, just say, okay, give them a specific amount of money to buy the equipment and then tell them how much you think it's going to reduce in revenue and budget it. I think a lot of this comes around to we want to pass these policy statements, but if it goes to Ways and Means and there's a fiscal, there's a potential that it may come out, so you try to avoid the fiscal. And I'm just saying that there's a balance here. You can do what you want to do, but if you really want to reduce gaming and reduce different things, I think you have to take into account the revenue impacts and just say, is it worth it? And I think that's an easy decision for many of you to make, but I do think as we look at the history of the lottery, that's the problem that's existed, is I think there's a lot of things we want from a social perspective, but the Ways and Means obviously doesn't always want it from a budget perspective. And I would like to say address Representative Greenlick's question, and I know Jeff's here, so he can come up. As somebody that has probably done more about gaming and gaming addiction than I ever cared to, I would argue video poker is a more addictive game. I think most people will say that. But the issue is, your audience is limited because a lot of people don't know how to play video poker. And so what happens is line games tends to be a less addictive game, but the audience is broader. So your populations is a different question, if that makes sense. I think that's kind of the balance between video and going to what I would call line games. So that's my perspective on that. If that makes sense to everybody.
We'll have a lot more time.
Yeah.
Can I comment on two things?
Okay.
I mean, I didn't get this information about addiction out of my fertile imagination, which has enough.
Oh, no.
I got it from visiting the lottery in that 2005 discussion,
Where
the director pointed out how social science had proven how to make line games more addictive. And that's what they were looking at proudly as a way of saying, okay, we can meet those projections. I mean, that's where that idea came from. So it's not something I just made up. But I think you're making a very important point about dealing with the consequences of policy decisions. My son's a criminal defense lawyer. And he tells me a lot of the white-collar crime that he defends is because people get addicted to video poker. And what we don't calculate is the social cost that goes with increasing the revenue, the prison expenses, the court expenses, all the things that go on, the family tragedies that affect family income. I mean, I think we absolutely need to be balancing revenue, and if we want to increase revenue, we need to know what's going to happen down on the Ways and Means side of it, as well as on the revenue side. And we don't do that. We've never calculated that. It's what the net income to the state is. And I think we need to be doing that.
Thank you, Representative. As I said before, we'll have lots more time to discuss these issues in February. But any quick questions, Mr. Perry? Okay, thank you so much for coming. With that, I think, Mr. Co-Chair, we're going to close the informational hearing on LC 90. No, wait a minute. 108. Thank you. And do you want to open up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next item, colleagues, is LC 96, so I'd like to open an informational meeting on that draft.
Chairs and member, a brief background. House Bill 3102 from 2011 established the CASA Task Force, and it provided for a January 15th deadline for the task force to make recommendations to the legislature. This concept, LC 96, was prepared about 6 weeks prior to completion of the task force's work in order to meet Legislative Council's drafting deadline, so it may not perfectly mirror the final recommendations that guests are here to talk about today. Just want everyone to keep that in mind. It was a function of creating a placeholder for potential legislation due to the deadlines and the report not coming out until a few days ago. So in its current form, it affects the transfer of authority over court-appointed special advocates and CASA volunteer programs from the State Commission on Children and Families to the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, OVCVA, as by way of shorthand, effective May 1st, 2012, and it sets forth the OVCVA's duties and responsibilities. It also creates a court-appointed special advocate fund for continuous appropriations to the Housing and Community Services Department for the OVCVA to provide the services of court-appointed special advocates in this state. It also contains a sunset provision for repeal in January 2nd, 2016, and that accounts for about half of its length.
Thank you for that summary. And colleagues, we have two folks to testify. One is our own Jim Thompson. I'll ask him to go down there now. Is Leola McKenzie here? Please come forward. And the last one is Rick Crager. We weren't sure Rick's here. If you'd come up, Rick, now, we can have the panel. It's noted that Judge Easterday and Brian Bocas could not be here. I would say with Senator Boquist, special forces training, you never know if he's actually in the room or not. So just be aware.
And if he is in the room, you may not be able to see him.
So, Representative, if you'll kick us off with your expertise, we'll appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Thompson, State Representative from House District 23, and I served on the interim task force on what to do with the CASA program. It was not a straight shot on how to deal with this. A couple of problems that came up very early. As you know, we are addressing this because the State Commission on Children and Families is going away, and it left this very important program dangling that doesn't necessarily go anyplace. So we were looking at how we might remedy this. One of the problems that became apparent very early on, which is not isolated to State Commission on Children and Families, is that much of the work or budget work that was done with CASA was being absorbed across the spectrum of that organization. So once we got into identifying the budget, it wasn't a standalone pick it up and transfer it next door budget, and that's created a very large problem because we have a budgetary deficit, I think we like to use the term, in how to make this work, and that's something we still have to address in the Ways and Means process. What you have before you is an LC draft that largely represents the work of the interim committee. There are possible changes we're going to want to make in this, and Leola will be covering those. So this isn't a perfect document yet. We will have a bill ready, obviously, when we come back in February. But I think the biggest issue in my mind yet to be dealt with is how we can fairly fund this operation in its new home. And I want to compliment the Commission on Voluntary Action and Service for their willingness to work with us on this, but they don't have funding, and I understand their parent organization, which I'm sure you're going to hear, doesn't have funding, and they just got their funding reduced. So we don't have to worry about sweeping their ending fund balance. They don't have one. So we're going to have to fund this somehow. We may have to divert funds from the operational side of the budget into the funding of the commission part of it, which I don't favor, but I'm not sure where Ways and Means is going to find money. And we've gotten several estimates from different commissions that were looked at as possible homes. They all came in very close, and it's a lot more money than was on the table with the dissolution of Children and Families. So that's the key issue. The other is, of course, how much money can we appropriate, which will tie very directly to how much we can expect the Volunteer Commission to accomplish in their goals. So we may have to trim the responsibilities we're asking them to take over if we don't fund this adequately. So I hate the word Band-Aid, but you're going to see a lot of that, I think, in this bill. That we're trying to find a home that will work, will allow us to stabilize and look toward growth of the CASA program, but we may not be able to put this thing on in high speed immediately. Hence, we'll be looking at it again in 2016. Or thereabouts. It's going to be a continuous babysitting project to keep this working. So with that, I defer to my colleagues here.
Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam, my name is Leola McKenzie. I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I'm here today as a member of the task force. As your staff indicated when she introduced this bill was written prior to the task force finishing our work, and the task force received a copy of this bill at the I'm sorry, the task force received a copy of this bill following our last meeting. So we haven't met together as a task force to look at the bill in detail and to see if there are any recommended changes. Personally, as a task force member, I have three concerns with the bill. The first one is that the LC amends the definition of CASA volunteer program by removing the responsibility of the local juvenile court to approve or sanction a local CASA program. I had the opportunity to discuss this proposed change in definition with a number of judges across the state, and they unanimously have said that they would like to keep that authority of the local court to be able to approve or sanction a local program. We don't necessarily believe that there's anything inherently inconsistent with the Oregon Volunteers Commission providing the contracting of funds to the local program and the local juvenile court approving or sanctioning a local program. So that's one of the areas that we'd really like you to consider changing. The second one is that this LC really goes far beyond what the current administrative responsibilities of the State Commission on Children and Family are. And during each of the task force meetings, there were discussions about the funding and the budget and you know, whatever you ask an administering agency to do, things are going to cost money. So there is a lot of concern. I have a lot of concern that we're putting more responsibilities on the state in overseeing and managing CASA programs in this draft. And that would be something that I think that the Oregon Volunteers Commission would have as well. Finally, as it was noted earlier, this bill repeals CASA provisions effective January 2, 2016. I think that the reason for that is because the Oregon Volunteers Commission wanted to have the opportunity to re-examine the fit of CASA within the organization sometime in 2014. The Chief Justice also made a commitment to look at the possibility of, is there a way to move CASA under the judicial branch umbrella by the end of 2014. My concern is that having everything related to CASA evaporate in 2016, that's not a good thing for kids and families. I am available to work with Representative Thompson or members of the committee or members of the task force to go through these in detail and provide additional information and suggestions.
And as we said about the earlier LC, that we'll certainly have more hearings on this and input.
Yeah, we'll be there. It's just that we're kind of in limbo right now.
Right, so. Got that. Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Co-chair Tomei, co-chair Gilliam. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the deputy director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and most of you are probably wondering, well, what the heck is the housing guy doing up here in relation to this particular testimony? As mentioned, as Representative Thompson had said, Oregon Housing Community Services is I guess we would call it the home for Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action Services. Back early in 2000, there was a transfer of the Commission for Voluntary Actions and Services to our department. We certainly see a nexus between our community resources programs that we have in and operate in the department and the Volunteers Commission. And we've had a very successful working relationship with the commission over the last 10 years. They do, as you probably know, have their own, obviously, commission. They have their own executive director, who is Kathleen Joy, that's back here in the back and is the true expert on the program pieces of the Commission for Voluntary Action Services. But again, it's been a very successful relationship that we've had with them over the years. We as an agency are responsible for kind of the basic standard administrative oversight, particularly as it relates to budget. So anything that's budgetary limitation comes through the budget of Oregon Housing Community Services. I guess I would first like to just say and compliment Representative Thompson and the task force. There's a lot of work and effort put into this. It's not an easy solution. As the representative said, this is potentially more of a Band-Aid type approach, trying to find a home for the costs of volunteers that is somewhat close to what an organization's mission tasks may be. And I do think that in speaking to Kathleen, we do see a lot of obvious connections between the Commission of Voluntary Action Services and CASAS. So we are very happy to provide support to this committee in trying to identify the commission as a temporary home. I think as Leola had mentioned, one of our areas of real concern here is around the administrative capacity. Just so you know, the Commission of Voluntary Action Services is a very lean, small staff. Kathleen Joy back here is the primary support for the commission. There are a couple other FTE that are in our budget along with some contracted support functions, but it's a very limited staffing, and they have just enough to be able to operate their AmeriCorps programs. I think, obviously, if we were to take on the responsibility and the oversight for this particular program, there would be some administrative cost associated with this. We, in working with Representative Thompson, want to be as prudent as possible. We understand and recognize the situation with the state. There's not a lot of resources, so we want to make this as lean as possible. As we look at the LC in its current format, there are a few areas that we are concerned about that look to broaden the role of the state. We think the task force made some good recommendations on how some of that could be resolved through some statewide organization, but that would be outside of the state's responsibility. And as the LC is currently written, it would appear that the state holds that responsibility, which I would say to you, if it stayed in that format, the fiscal would probably be much larger than what we would perhaps estimate in more of a standard type administrative function. So that's something I definitely want to point out to the committee, that I think there are ways, and the task force had recommended there are ways to handle that. We would like to have that opportunity to work with the committee to fix those areas and make this transfer as easy as possible for everyone. So I think that concludes my testimony, and certainly happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for the panel?
Well, one last thing that I think we have to keep in
Representative mind Thompson, go ahead.
On this is that, unlike a lot of organizations that we work with here, this is a volunteer organization. They contribute thousands of hours, and contribute is the active word, to the local foster kids and the court system. So it's not like we're trying to fund a bloated state bureaucracy. We're trying to find the support funds to keep a very valuable volunteer cadre together and move it forward, because we need many more CASAs in most parts of the state, not fewer. We need more training, not less. So the weight is on us to find a way to throw the nickels in for dollars of return. And of course, this is not a good time to be having that discussion, but I really want to compliment the housing people and the Commission on Voluntary Action and Service for their willingness to take this on, because we talked to a number of agencies who, first of all, were unwilling with the fiscal climate that we're in, or their cost demands to do it were just totally unreasonable. We would have had no budget left for CASA if we went that route. So this is the most cost-effective, sharp-pencil route that we've been able to identify. But funding is going to be an issue now and in the future if we really want this program to flourish. And we can't do it on the backs of volunteers with no central organization that we have a stake in. So it's a big, big deal to find a way to keep this thing propelled forward.
Thank you. Another comment.
Co-Chair Galen, Co-Chair Tomei, one thing I failed to add, and I know Kathleen would bonk me on the head if I didn't mention this, and I think Representative Thompson briefly touched on it. The Commission, I should note for the record, certainly has been presented with some recent challenges that we never anticipated. As of January 1st, the federal funding that has supported supported the Commission for Voluntary Action Service was essentially cut in half. So Kathleen and her staff have been frantically trying to figure out how to continue to preserve its AmeriCorps programs and continue to operate. Having said that, again, we still remain committed and working with Representative Thompson and the task force in trying to figure out a way. But I thought it was just important for the record for you to know that there is certain challenges that the Commission itself is trying to deal with. It's not a good financial climate anywhere, obviously. But again, we think with the appropriate language in the bill and the small amount of fiscal money, or I should say financial dollars, that we would need to support that administrative function, we would be able to pull it off.
Any comments or questions before we move on? Thank you all. Representative White.
I think one of the other struggles I heard, and you can probably enlighten me too, but one of the bloated state bureaucracies was throwing on some pretty heavy accounting fees. I think DAS was like $170,000 is what I heard. Can anybody confirm that with the move that they were trying to put on your budget?
It's not even as easy as that. When you start going through the budget, you can't take a small organization like CASA and cut it out of a larger budget because it apparently never had a truly audited freestanding budget. So the money that was there was the budget, but a lot of things were being done by other people not in that budget. So it was being spread and absorbed other places. And for that reason, we don't even have a clear accounting of how much money was being spent to administer CASA, but it was certainly, it certainly appears to be more than what the budget number is. And somehow or they're now in moving it to another agency, they're taking a look at it saying this, how many FTE are going to have to be allocated to CASA, and that's not what we had before because there wasn't a close accounting. And not calling anything nefarious was happening. It was just a tendency for a lot of people and children and families to come together and make this work when it was underfunded. But when we transfer it, we can't transfer it underfunded until some other agency, you figure out a way to suck it up. You know, we're going to have to be more businesslike. But yeah, some of these other things are issues.
Okay. Thank you all for being here and for your testimony.
Thanks. Talk about it.
You know, I'll make a quick comment before I close this. I want to be mindful of my co-chair's admonition that we will have plenty of time to go in depth on these. But it occurs to me as we're sitting here listening to this, this issue, CASA and foster care, is one of the classics that we face as members of this committee and looking at human services. In tight budgets, the things that actually can alleviate problems and suffering, particularly in the lives of young people in this case, can actually save us money. Mm-hmm. So here we are talking about programs not only that are valuable for real people and real children, we also can save the state money because of what they do. That is not any news to this committee, but it's just a frustration I think we all have. And this, to me, is a perfect example, and I hope we have more discussions. So that's my comment on that. And if I may, Madam Chair, I'll move on, and I will close that informational hearing on the LC-96, and I will open informational hearings on LC Draft 256 and LC Draft 259. And Cheyenne, will you brief us a little bit on those?
Chairs and members of the committee, LC 256, dated 1/18, that's at the dais and available on the shared drive, relating to elderly persons, creates the crime of assault in the third degree for knowing or intentional injury to an elderly victim, requires certain felony prosecutions involving the elderly to commence within 6 years, prohibits orders setting aside convictions or arrest records for criminal mistreatment in the first or second degree when the victim is elderly, modifies access to records and information about elderly victims in certain circumstances during abuse investigations, creates the safety, resident safety review council to sunset June 30th, 2013, permits persons convicted of certain crimes to be that is to accept employment as public employees in contact with vulnerable persons under certain conditions, expresses an intent to continue the elder abuse work group during the upcoming interim until June 30th, 2013, and requires the Department of Human Services to accomplish a few things: establishing a statewide call system for receipt of reports of abuse required by ORS 124060, report to the legislature about that call system by October 1st, 2012, establish training and continuing education for non-law enforcement persons investigating the abuse of elderly persons, and report to the legislature by October 1st, 2013 about that, and also to apply for a specific federal grant by May 1st of 2012. LC-259, also dated 1-18-12, is a duplicate in its entirety of LC-256 up and to the bottom of page 32. The difference is it omits those requirements being imposed on the Department of Human Services, and it does not express an intent to continue the work group activity.
Thank you. Colleagues, I don't want to injure this bill before we get started, but because I'm going to tell you this is the one I'm excited about, so that may change your mind on it. And I would say, just as Representative Thompson mentioned in the last bill, you know, the work that volunteers do in the interim is incredible. This is the first really long-term work group that I've served on. I've been on some short-term ones. And this represents a lot of good work from people who gave up a lot of time and a lot of miles. And I'm very proud of this, what we've got. I am looking forward to a full discussion. And I think the best thing to do would be to have my co-chair on this work group come forward, Representative Hoyle. And then we'll move from that to the folks that you see listed. So my good co-chair, my other good co-chair, come forward and identify yourself, please.
Before we do that, Mr. Co-Chair, I assume that LC-259 was also dated January 18th?
Correct. Those are available at the dais.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hoyle.
Hi, my name is Val Hoyle. I'm a state representative for House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. And I want to thank you very much for allowing me to speak in front of you today. As Representative Gilliam said, we had a group of people that were so committed, did amazing work, and we feel like this is something that can move forward and really make a difference in the lives of elders and vulnerable people in our community. So, we were here in the last legislative days to present our recommendations, and we've continued to refine the legislative concepts with feedback from people on this committee and other people. So now you probably want to hear from the experts. I think that's better for everyone. We've got Matt Smith from the Forest Grove Police Department to go over the law enforcement piece. Jeff Aiken from the DHS Background Check Unit is here to go over some background check changes we're looking for. And Bethany Higgins, the Executive Director of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. She's here to discuss the creation of the Residential Safety Review Council. Now, before she comes up to speak about this, I want to let you know that we're not putting forward an unfunded mandate. We've proposed a funding source for the Residential Safety Review Council. The Quality Care Fund, which was established by the legislature in 2009, is appropriated for training, technical assistance, quality improvement initiatives, and licensing activities to ensure that high standards for quality care are met in accordance with rules adopted in respect to long-term care facilities, residential facilities, and adult foster homes. So the Quality Care Fund comes from all license fees paid by long-term care facilities, residential facilities, and adult foster homes. So their licensing fees are all put towards this fund. Civil penalties that are paid by residential facilities and adult foster homes are also directed into the Quality Care Fund. Civil penalties paid by long-term care facilities, nursing facilities, are required by federal law to be maintained in a separate account, and so they are. Currently, the fund balance for the Quality Care Fund is $868,302.80. There's 80 cents in there. So in any case, the purpose of these funds are for quality improvement within this population, and so we feel like it would be appropriate to use it for these efforts. So with no further ado, I would like to, if it's all right with you, chairs, Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, invite up Matt Smith from the Forest Grove Police Department and Jeff Aiken.
Thank you. You do the job better than I do.
No, I don't know about that. I also would like to say that there are other representatives that are working on bills on background checks, specifically Representative Nathanson and Representative Holvey, and they'll be hearing a bill on background checks for all systems on Friday in general government. And what we did was we took some of the recommendations, and as opposed to putting a separate background check changes in statute in our bill, we put that into the other bill. Come on up. We put it into the other bill so that we wouldn't just be working in silos and have DHS improve their background check procedures and then have, you know, education improve their background check procedures. We actually wanted to make sure it all happened together. So there will be some of these recommendations in that other bill.
And just so you know, colleagues, you're going to get a great slice of some of the work from both the department and from law enforcement. Yesterday in the House Judiciary Committee that Representative Tomei serves on, we focused on some of the, particularly some of the legal issues that Representative Hoyle talked about. But this has input, and we're going to save you today, but we have input from bankers, AARP, the list is very long, and we tried to focus here so that you could get an overview from these two folks. But believe me, this is a great cross-section of the group that worked.
And Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, I hate to leave you, but we have an expert that can come up and speak to you, Bethany Higgins, and I need to get back to the Business and Labor Committee. So again, thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to working with you.
Well, is that all right if she leaves with the?
No, I can. I can.
Long without it before we met him.
Yeah, Flea, he's beginning to sing. Is it all right if we start with you, JT?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Co-chairs Gilliam, co-chairs Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Aiken, the background check unit manager with the Department of Human Services, and I've provided you with some written statistical information, some testimony in regards to denials made to potential providers of care under ORS 443.004. In our legislative concept here, we are proposing some changes to what has been colloquially termed as the Never Never Crime List, and we wanted to add some efficiency and add some measure of relevancy to the crimes, to the actual care that's being provided. And what I provided you with gives a background look at the areas of care providers that have been impacted by this and the crimes in there. And what you can see on the many pages of crimes, we've broken it down by the years of conviction. So using theft one as an example, which is one of the crimes that we have proposed be removed from the Never Never Crime List. And before anyone thinks that that means that they get an automatic pass into providing care, by statute, any potential provider of care in these senior communities are required to go through a background check that includes a weighing test if they have any potentially disqualifying criminal or abuse history. And each of the crimes on this Never Never Crime List, including the ones that we're proposing are pulled off the list, will forever be subject to a review under the Wayne test. Detective Smith and I were discussing earlier the power of that Wayne test, and that we don't only look at the conviction. We bring in police reports, court information, and can look at the context of that criminal history in addition to the conviction itself. So looking at theft one, we have denied 73 individuals with theft one convictions that occurred in the 1980s. Now, some of those individuals had other criminal history, but many of them, that was their only contact with law enforcement. And what we've essentially said is that you, committed theft one, which could be a myriad of offenses ranging from outright theft, writing checks over a long period of time, or joyriding in your parents' car when you were 16 years old, 18, I guess, if it'd be an adult crime. We basically said that happened 30 years ago, and now you can never provide care to an individual again. Whereas some of the crimes we've asked to be added to this, such as aggravated animal abuse in the first degree, today that's only subject to a review. It's not permanently disqualifying. So we're hoping to amend some of the discrepancies in there. The other piece we've done is asked for some amendments to are authorizing statutes for background checks. In today's world, when an individual is denied for one of these crimes, they are, in addition to the denial, subject to a full Wayne test, which takes time, and are then given appeal rights as well. However, the law clearly states they may not hold this position, so we're giving them due process with no positive outcome for them. And at the end of the report that I've given you, over the year of 2011, 61 requests for hearing were received, and as 10 of those have actually gone to a contested case hearing through the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is a very lengthy, very costly process with no positive outcome possible for these individuals. So what we've asked for is to take that appeal right out and then direct the individuals, if they'd like a cure, to seek expunction if possible, or quite frankly, seek employment in other areas. So that's what I have for you. I'm welcome to answer any. I'm happy to welcome any questions you may have.
Any for this?
Why is there no possible positive outcome from an appeal?
With the law, 443004 states that they may not hold this position. Public funds may not be expended. So if the administrative law judge, for example, feels that the 1976 public indecency conviction is not relevant to their desire to be an adult foster home caregiver, and they overturn the department's denial, the statute still overrides and says they may not hold this position. We share your confusion, Representative Greenleaf.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's what we said.
Yeah. But taking away the right of appeal isn't the answer. It seems to me we need to clarify the right of appeal to override state law.
And that was discussed, if I recall.
If I recall correctly, Co-Chair Gilliam, it was we discussed it to a point, and I believe what we decided, the work group decided, was that, and it kind of ties into some other pieces there, that there are other legal means to seek to, you know, we've had one subject individual who had this was kind of a little story. They were convicted of public indecency in 1976 for skinny dipping. They wanted to be a home care worker. They were denied under 443004. And so they could, that person actually sought an expunction, was able to get that, and was then able to provide care. We had one other individual who, I can't remember the conviction they had, but it wasn't expungible. And so they requested a pardon from the governor. But the way that the Never Never crime list is currently written, if they have that conviction, they may not hold that position.
So am I correct in assuming that this legislation would change that?
That is correct. That is correct.
It changes it, or it takes away the appeal
right? It takes away the appeal right. Oh. To clarify, Co-Chair, it takes away the appeal right in regards to the background check. So let me step back and clarify. So an individual wants to provide care in a senior setting, adult foster home, home care worker, etc. They have one of these convictions, which the statute states they may not hold this position. So they are denied as a result of that. The statute currently says anyone that is denied has the right to appeal that denial for that placement or employment. What we are proposing, because the statute is very clear that they may not work there, so an administrative law judge today can't say, even though the statute says you cannot hold this position, the administrative law judge isn't able to overturn that and say, well, yes, you can. And so what we have proposed is that instead of allowing them to go through that process to say, yes, you're overturned and now you can provide care, we're sticking to the intent of the perceived intent of 443004 and just not allowing them to, the public funds to be expended, not allowing them to provide care. And then as a department, we'd be providing them, without providing legal advice, clearly, but providing them directions to have other avenues that may include not providing care in this area.
I can't believe someone who's convicted of skinny dipping and has been cleaned, so to speak, yeah, since then. I mean, that there wouldn't be a route of appeal. It just doesn't make sense.
Okay.
Cheyenne, would you explain what we have a little, just a clarification on the document you were referring to?
The chairs and members of the committee, Mr. Aiken did provide these materials in advance, and we staff apologizes if we misunderstood that we thought they were for your personal reference.
Oh, no.
And so we're just handing them out after the fact, and we'll follow up with electronic copies as well.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I'm going to move on, and we can revisit this one as we clarify the bill. Matt, I want to save your presentation just for the end. If it's okay with you, Bethany, I'd like you to go next.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I am Bethany Higgins, Executive Director for the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. I'm here specifically today to talk to you about the proposal for the Resident Safety Review Council that is a part of the work and outcome from the Elder Abuse Work Group. I believe you have a PowerPoint presentation that you can refer to. Is that correct? I had sent it in advance.
Members of the committee, yes.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I'm not talking about something that everybody's like, what is she talking about? Exactly. So, thank you. I'll pull it up then. Perfect. Yes, thank you. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
So with that, what I wanted to share with you was a few slides that we used when we were originally invited to speak with the Elder Abuse Work Group. I'm sure for many members of the committee, this is not new information. It's been around for quite a while. But the Institute of Medicine report is really the first time that nationally we started paying a lot of attention to this issue around patient safety. And the idea that there are a lot of system errors that are caused, that cause harm, quite frankly, and significant harm. The cost, in addition to just the human lives, is significant to the healthcare delivery system. It costs a lot of extra money. There's also trust in the healthcare system that's eroded. Our patients experience all kinds of physical and psychological pain associated with these events. The healthcare profession certainly endures a loss of morale and frustration, and the worker productivity issue is not insignificant either. This report identified six key aims for improvement, and you can see safety front and center there, that no patient should ever be harmed. And so these are the areas that, for the last 16 years of my career, we've been targeting improvement efforts around. But the idea is that if you are able to create a system that is not only safe and reliable, but timely, effective, efficient, equitable, and patient-centered, that we would be able to eliminate, if not prevent altogether, these harm events. So a safety culture looks something like this. In a perfect world, we would have this just culture that we often refer to. And that culture would be one of transparency and learning. It would design very safe and reliable systems of care. There's a significant part of this that I want to emphasize, and the complexity of managing human beings in a very complex system is not insignificant, and there's a lot of education that goes along with doing that. So that's a big piece of building a safe culture. Teamwork and communication, the way that we communicate with each other, and those reliable design principles I mentioned are significant. So on the heels of all of this, the state of Oregon, many of you are probably aware, created the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, and that was in 2003. As a matter of fact, Representative Greenlick was a part of the original House bill and legislation. And so this is a semi-independent state agency, and we exist on the fees from our adverse event reporting program, as well as many grants that support our work around building this safer healthcare system for Oregon citizens. We have a very diverse board, and I want to share with you just a snapshot of the diversity that we have in our board of directors. There's 17 members, but you can see that it spans the healthcare delivery system. We have everything from hospital administrators, nursing home administrators, insurers, consumers, purchasers. You get the idea. We're crossing the whole gamut here. So this is a little bit of a snapshot of the history of our organization. Although we're relatively young, you can see that in our early years, we were really focused on our adverse event reporting program. And during that time, we were able to build the kind of staff and expertise that it takes to be able to manage that kind of a program. In addition to that, over the last couple of years, I've been in place for just over a year now. We've been able to extend a lot of our grant funding, specifically in the area of infection prevention work around collaboratives and working with frontline partners, if you will, to reduce infections and things that are preventable. This is another snapshot just to give you an idea of the more broad base and functions of the Commission. I'm going to focus now, though, on the Adverse Event Reporting Program and our expertise in this area. This is just a snapshot of some of our healthcare partners, and what I wanted to mention here was that it's only responsible for us to work in collaboration. It's one of our guiding principles. We work with many partners that I'm sure many of you are familiar with to work these programs and to find a balance so that we're not being redundant with our programs and we make the biggest impact we can and the right kind of progress. So another good background slide to mention to the committee is there is a difference between what I would call the more traditional approach, what we would call quality assurance. The idea was early on that if there was an error, you punish those involved, you're reactive after it happens, and you collect and count those events. Quality improvement and the science behind this patient safety philosophy is that these adverse events are preventable for the most part because of these complex systems we're referring to. There are ways that we can learn from these events and share that information, and we can provide system solutions through that learning and sharing and design systems in a more reliable way. And so there's a difference between those philosophies, and I think it's important to point that out. So as we were having the opportunity to talk with the Elder Abuse Work Group, this is the visual that came to mind when we were having the discussion, and that is that there's this large universe of adverse events, and there's a smaller universe of what we would call true abuse investigation type events. There's probably the potential for a small amount of overlap. We believe there are a few instances where they could overlap, but in reality, it would look something like this. Today, we theorize that the way that we're administratively managing them today, it's sort of inverted. It's a little different. So there are large things that are problems, obviously. People experienced situations that were maybe not intended. But it looks like that there's a lot of overlap, a lot more than we would have thought. So with that in mind, this pilot concept is really to create a resident safety review council. And the idea is that we actually take a look at these abuse investigations through root cause analysis, a tool that we're skilled and fortunate to have the opportunity to use, and that we would work with our partners, so Department of Health Services, senior and people with disabilities, ombudsman, et cetera, and we would collaborate and come together and look at these events and classify them appropriately and see what we could learn from that, and potentially make recommendations by February of next year that could influence future legislation and perhaps help us not only administratively deal with them in a different manner or a more streamlined way, but ultimately what's in it for the Commission, I think, is an ability to collaborate with our partners and create something that would still produce a safer healthcare system and perhaps reduce some of the burden administratively that's existing today upon those frontline partners. So we're hoping to be able to use this as a way to redesign, if you will. And with our expertise and help with the collaborators we have at the table, that's why we're here to talk about it. So thank you very much for your time and for listening. I'm very happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for that presentation. If there are no questions or comments at this point, we will move on to Detective Smith. Thank you.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for allowing me to address you today regarding the work that was performed on this work group. For the purpose of brevity, I'm going to focus on aspects that are going to directly affect law enforcement if this bill successfully passes. So what initially caused me to want to get involved in this in the first place was some trends I was seeing in elder abuse investigations that I was directly involved in. Going into detectives from a patrol officer, I spent about half my time working on child sex abuse and about half my time working on senior citizens who were being victimized. And John Wentworth yesterday from the Clackamas County DA's office said something that I thought was extremely accurate, was that we're about 25 years behind the bell curve on how we investigate elder abuse cases. We have protection systems in place for us to move in quickly and rapidly to respond to a child who's been physically or sexually abused. When it comes to a senior citizen, our system is completely lethargic, and there are holes. And I'd like to point some of those holes out to you today. One of the things that I did see that was very similar was how my victims were being identified by suspects. We commonly use the term grooming when we use terms for suspects in child sex abuse cases, because suspects will locate a child and then take actions to gain their trust and then victimize them. In much the same ways, a lot of my suspects do the exact same thing with senior citizens. They find a vulnerable senior citizen and then use the protection systems that we have in place to take advantage of them and victimize them. Their methods are methodical and comprehensive. They use documents like power of attorneys, which are used to really facilitate assisting seniors when they become disabled, and they actually turn those documents against them and use them to victimize them. This bill is a response to those actions in the past to save lives and livelihoods. This allows for prosecution for those physically abusing senior citizens as a Class B felony. One of the things that the bill allows is that if you cause physical injury really intentionally or knowingly to a senior citizen now, it comes under the Assault 3 statute. Currently, if you assault a senior citizen knowingly or intentionally, it's a misdemeanor. The most important part of this, as an investigating perspective, is Section 6 through 12, which would allow law enforcement and Department of Human Services personnel to be able to get access to a senior citizen's medical records if necessary. Part of the reason for this is that a lot of the victims that I'm encountering have varying levels of dementia. So in a normal scenario, I can simply go to a victim, and if they've been assaulted or sexually assaulted or they're the victim of a crime, I can merely ask for their permission to review their bank records or to view their medical records to prove that they have a broken bone of some sort. When you're dealing with a victim who has dementia, they don't have the ability to grant consent for me to either look at their medical records to verify they are the victim of a crime or to go into their financial records to show that they had $10,000 or $15,000 stolen from them. The reason for this is currently I'm having to write search warrants to gain access just to my victim's records. And when I deliver a search warrant to a bank, it can take anywhere between 3 weeks to 2 months for me to get my victim's records back. And in the meantime, their accounts are being completely drained. What this bill would allow us to do is to allow law enforcement and DHS to move in quickly, just for the victim's perspective, for me to determine whether or not we have a crime, and to try to figure out who's the ones behind it. Many of these victims are socially and physically isolated from family, friends, and protective service personnel. As a result of that, it makes getting a hold of these records even more difficult. Many suspects use this seclusion in order to avoid detection and apprehension. And then the HIPAA statute is then utilized by suspects to hide their victimization. Currently, the suspects know that if they don't grant access to the victim to me and they're stealing tens of thousands of dollars from them, I can't go to them and have them sign a piece of paper giving me consent to look at their bank records because they have varying levels of dementia.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Sure. We have an interruption.
Not there. What do you do in a case? Like if there's a trust or power of attorney on accounts, are those still ones that you look at? Because I know lots of times senior citizens, once they get to a certain stage, they have a power of attorney to a family member, a couple different family members, possibly a couple of their children. Those instances where you run into investigation quite a bit, and how would you go about getting the records when they've signed over a power of attorney?
Currently, what I'm having to do is compile my evidence into a search warrant affidavit. I'm having to write a warrant to get the victim's bank records. In a lot of my cases, the power of attorney, the individual who has power of attorney, is the one who's actually stealing from the senior citizen. And a lot of times what they're doing is just simply not cooperating, either providing access for me to even speak to the victim or not granting me access to be able to review the records in the first place.
I'm just trying to process this. Do you have a scenario or a case that you could give us an example of what would trigger a red flag for you to go look at something like that?
Yeah, I had a case. The gentleman's pictures are actually at the end of this presentation. His family has given me permission to show his images and to talk about his case. He had a family friend named Sean Villhauer, who he allowed to be his power of attorney. He'd known him for years. He had sisters that lived in Central Oregon who weren't nearby. And so initially the family didn't think that there were any issues. However, they became suspicious because it seemed like he didn't have a lot of money and there were some bills that weren't being paid and they were being contacted by collections agencies. They began calling this trusted family friend and asking him, what's going on with my brother's money? And he was making comments that, well, he's broke, I'm paying the bills, I have an itemized list, I'll get back to you. Well, this went on for some time, and eventually the family contacted law enforcement and adult protection services. In the meantime, he had suffered a series of medical issues. He had fallen and broken his hip. He had been in and out of the hospital. When he was having surgery on his hip, he had a stroke. He had terminal cancer. He had bladder cancer at the time. So he had a number of medical issues, and he was being moved from one care facility to the other in multiple police jurisdictions as well. So when they were calling the police department, they were kind of getting the runaround of who they should speak to. When Adult Protection Services got involved, they went out and attempted to interview Mr. Vilhauer, but were not successful in getting cooperation from him. And as a result of that, they actually came to me. They actually called me at one point, and the only reason that I took the investigation was I knew the worker, I didn't want her to keep getting the runaround, and he had lived in Forest Grove for a period of time when some of the abuse occurred. What I ended up having to do in that case was, because he didn't have capacity, I went and interviewed him. And he had dementia so significantly, I didn't feel that I could ethically ask him for permission to look at his bank records. I felt that would be unethical for me. So I had to write a search warrant to be able to look at the suspect's bank records, and it took me about a month and a half to get those records from the bank after I delivered the warrant. And in that interim period of time, I just kept thinking, if he has savings, if he has pensions, if he has money, that money could be completely moved from the account by the time I get these records. And ultimately, when I got the records, I found that $60,000 had been stolen over a period of time, and was able to prove it using the bank records. But imagine for a moment if this was a family member of yours, and you're waiting a month and a half just to find out if where the money is, if it's being drained as we speak, and if what this bill would allow law enforcement to do is move it much more swiftly to put a stop to that.
If I may follow up?
Sure.
Are most of the cases where it's an outside family member or a non-family member who's been given power of attorney that you're running into where the problems exist, or lots of times they have family members that are the ones that are the abusers or the ones taking the funds?
Most of the time it's family members or a trusted friend. And one thing that we're starting to see as a trend is last week even we had a bank contact Adult Protection Services and tell them that they had a problem involving one of their customers, and it did involve a family member. So we are starting to get financial institutions calling, but unfortunately financial institutions currently aren't disclosing enough information for us to really begin a comprehensive investigation. Just giving us a name, pointing in a general direction, just isn't sufficient for me to put into a search warrant affidavit and show to a judge that I have cause to look in someone's bank records. So in a lot of instances, this bill could, A, speed up our response time, and B, it'll allow us to determine whether or not we have a crime occurring in the first place. Because unlike a lot of other instances, I can't go to the victim and just simply ask them.
Please continue.
Like I just touched on a second ago, from my experience talking with banks and talking with healthcare providers, these are the people on the front lines that are actually beginning to alert law enforcement when we have problems. This bill actually gives them protections to be able to communicate with us more freely. I've had numerous discussions with physicians and bankers who want to assist in identifying elder abuse as it's occurring and assist us in our investigations in what capacity they can. This bill affords them some protections when they do so. The financial record component is going to be extremely helpful for law enforcement. Currently, when I'm writing search warrants, I'm getting inundated with financial records that I really don't need and ultimately really don't want, but I have to ask for basically a period of time. A few months ago now, I got a search warrant response back from Wells Fargo that took about 2 months, and I got thousands of pages of records, and I'm having to sort through all of them. Currently, I would be able to go down to if this bill passes, I can go down to a local branch or bank and just focus on the allegations of theft that I'm looking for. If I'm looking for an allegation of theft for $15,000 or $20,000 during a specified period of time, it'd be very easy for me, if this were in statute, for me to simply go to the bank and ask them, I'm looking for a $20,000 transaction in August that I believe was stolen. Can you help me with that? And in the long run, it's going to speed up investigations and I think protect privacy, because I don't have all of the patient's medical records. I just simply want some indication whether or not this person has been deemed to have dementia and to what extent. And what I need is just a physician speaking to me. One other component is the creation of the 211 toll-free telephone number for vulnerable person abuse reporting. Currently, it's far too confusing to locate the appropriate telephone number to call. When this first got brought up, I actually went out to our squad room and asked five different officers what number they should provide the public to call if there's a case of elder abuse, and I got five different answers, and none of them are right. So for people that are supposed to be trusted to provide this information out to the public, a 211 operating system to me seems like a very common sense response to that. It'll be a tool that the public can use, and more importantly, it's going to be a tool that we will be able to use as professionals to get a hold of people regarding elder abuse if our officers on the front lines have problems. Currently at Forest Grove, the people they're calling is me at home after hours if there's an issue, and I direct them to the proper resource.
And we have the 211 now?
So
I was off visiting them, in fact, a couple of weeks ago.
It's not specified for elder abuse reporting currently.
We have 211, but this would utilize that line, so to speak.
Yeah, there. That's
one of the problems with it. You got 211, 411, 811. The only one I know is 911, what it does. So.
511, too.
That's one my kids usually call when they're little and they first learn to dial from school.
All right, we need to keep on point here, so we got to keep moving.
I think the ultimate benefit is going to be in certain economically depressed areas of the state. This is going to be a great advantage for officers and for staff when they need to provide information and allow citizens to call in and report these abuse cases. If they don't get reported, it's going to be very difficult for us to investigate them. The Section 6, 8, 10, and 12 are going to be imperative for law enforcement. I think this has the potential to be an absolute game changer for how we do elder abuse investigations. These provisions do not allow us access to suspects' records. That's not what we're asking for, because in those cases, we need to write court orders and search warrants to gain access to those. The problem is that in any other crime, if we have a victim, we can just simply go talk to them. We can provide a HIPAA waiver to them. They can sign it. If they have a broken bone, they've been sexually assaulted. In these cases involving senior citizens with extreme levels of dementia, I can't ethically go there and ask them to sign a HIPAA waiver form, nor can I ask them permission to look at their medical records. What we're going to need to do, especially with the baby boomers beginning to retire, we're going to have an onslaught of these financial abuse cases. I have no doubt of that. We're seeing that now. This bill would allow law enforcement and DHS to respond quickly and aggressively to elder abuse allegations and be able to hopefully put a stop to it. There is absolute exigency to obtain these records. If we're looking at somebody who's losing tens of thousands of dollars, waiting 2 months to get victims' records back is just unacceptable. The evidence that we get from these, and ultimately if we go after our suspects' records, it can be judicially reviewed via a search warrant through a grand jury proceeding. Senior citizens suffering from advanced dementia is being victimized by their caretaker as a silent victim. They may not have a family or loved ones looking after them, and there may only be a bank teller, a concerned physician, or an attentive DHS employee or a police officer to intervene on their behalf. An example of this is Mr. Gary Murray, who was the victim that I referenced earlier, who was the victim of a $60,000 theft. This is my first opportunity to meet him when I went up to actually see what his level of dementia was. Mr. Murray was suffering from a variety of medical conditions. He couldn't even grip a pencil when I talked to him. He was falling and virtually incoherent when I was talking to him, but allegedly, according to my suspect, was fully mentally competent and able to write checks, and he had lost $60,000 by the time I had contacted him because he had gotten the runaround for so long. This case really motivated me to get involved in elder abuse cases because I don't know how many more Gary Murrays are there out in Oregon. He's a man who was a veteran of the U.S. Navy, had owned his own business in the state of Arizona, and died before my case could even get presented to a grand jury. He deserved better than what he had, and he died destitute and alone in a nursing facility in Portland. We have to do everything we can to give tools to law enforcement and DHS personnel to intervene for citizens like Gary Murray in our state who are being victimized and don't have the capacity to ask for help. And I'm willing to answer any questions the committee has, and I thank you for your time.
We had some questions, but if we have others, please.
I just want to make a statement. We remember from previous testimony in this committee that people living in extended living situations, 60% of them never get a visitor. Mm-hmm. Those, I think, are the most vulnerable.
Yeah, I remember that. Other comments or questions? Thank you for that. Again, Detective Smith, you're almost a representative. You spent enough time here. You know, there's a good and a bad whenever the detective gives presentations or talks in our work group. I always think how fortunate we are to have him and his expertise. But the other side is, I think, this is one detective from Forest Grove. And to your point, there are so many folks, and there will be many more. We've had presentations in this committee when Representative Cowan was with us about the growing population in Oregon and the migration. So you're absolutely correct. And one of the reasons I think we need to start, this bill doesn't do everything, but we need to start bringing our standards in Oregon up to protecting elders. And so I appreciate it very much. But you remind me of what a huge field it is. And I appreciate your both of you being here as well. We're trying to find balance. I hope that came through with the three that we had present from the committee. You know, when you're looking for a facility, let's say, for a loved one, and you look up the so-called record of abuse, that's one of the problems that we're trying to deal with. An adverse event versus criminal activity is a very important thing for families. And I'm not saying this bill completely clarifies it, but that's what we're working toward. And one of the reasons I really appreciated hearing this presentation again, we heard it in the work group. So these are just some of the issues that we're trying to deal with. I think we've cleared up a minor relating clause issue, and so we'll present this at the end of our hearing today along with the other proposed committee bills. Have I left anybody out, or are there any other comments? I think I've gone through my list correctly. I hate to move on because I'm so proud of the work you guys did, but I'll let it go for now and appreciate everybody's attention and for you being here. With that, Madam Chair, I will close the informational meeting on LC drafts 256 and 259 and turn the gavel to you.
Are we going to do the work session?
We put off the work session till last.
Got
the
it.
LCs are pending.
Oh, we're waiting.
Right. Got it.
Mr. Okay. Chair, will it be easier to report you for picking on me for elder abuse?
I'm not going to call. Rare too.
I'm going to open the informational meeting regarding the Early Learning Council and Senate Bill 909 and the 2011 report. And we have invited testimony. We have Duke Shepherd from the Governor's Office, Senior Policy Advisor, Labor and Human Services, Pam Curtis, Deputy Director for the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, Oregon Health and Sciences University, and the Early Learning Council member, and Swati Adarkar, am I pronouncing that correctly? Thank you. She's President and CEO of the Children's Institute, and we have Mary Louise McClintock.
Madam Chair, Mary Louise was not able to be here.
Okay, thank you very much. So proceed.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you. Again, for the record, Duke Shepherd, Governor's Office. I thought we would do a little context setting because as much activity as there was on early learning last session, none of it happened in this committee. And so this is my first visit to you along with my friends here. So we will quickly set things up and then walk through some the recommendations. And in the interest of time, I thought I would focus on the elements of the report that will be in legislation. I do not yet have my LC draft back, but I know what I submitted, so I can walk through that. So if right now, I'll turn it over to Swati.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Co-Chair Gilliam and Tomei, and the rest of the committee for inviting us here today to talk about an issue that I think we're all very passionate about, which is helping to make sure all our children in Oregon are successful in school and getting that going as early as possible. I am Swati Adarkar, the President and CEO of the Children's Institute. We are a research and policy organization focused on ensuring all Oregon children arrive at kindergarten prepared and ready for success and meeting those key third grade benchmarks. Why are we so concerned and focused on the early years? It's becoming less of a mystery to folks why so many people are beginning to look at the earliest possible stage when we think about learning and education. But we know that if children arrive at kindergarten behind, the data is very clear that it's highly unlikely that they're going to catch up and that achievement gap is well entrenched by kindergarten. And as you know, our public investments in education start really as for a full year in first grade. And so in many senses, in terms of our public investments, we're forced to play catch up. And so the reason we're focused there is because we know that that's where we can really make the biggest difference in setting that longer-term trajectory for children, particularly low-income children and many children who are children of color who are living in limited-income families. The third grade success measure is also very key because, as you many of you know, this is a key predictor of high school graduation. And so when children particularly aren't reading at grade level by third grade, we begin to see the dropout rate start there, even though children actually walk out when they're much bigger. We've learned so much about neuroscience in the last 20 years in terms of brain development. So when we think about the seeds to learning and brain architecture, we know that that begins prenatally, and the kinds of issues you're looking at really bridge that key area of both health and education. And really, early childhood takes a look at these domains that look at much more than just education. And I think it's really important for this committee's work to help us look at those connections. Language delays now can be detected as early as 9 months. And it seems so surprising to people when we talk about achievement gaps to think about a child who's crawling. It seems kind of unfathomable to us. But the research and evidence is, in fact, so clear that those seeds of learning and the wiring of the brain begin at the earliest stage of development. And so it is for these kinds of reasons that we find ourselves so focused on early education and development, because Nobel economists and neuroscientists, business leaders, leaders across the country are calling for investments in high-quality early care and education for a very important reason, which is that that's the area with the biggest return on investment. In the area of social science and human development, we so rarely have the sort of robust evidence that we have that looks at longitudinal studies. And what we know is whether you're looking at a rate of return of 1 to 4 or 1 to 17, it's a pretty good rate. And the investments Oregon has been making in this regard have been serving us well. The Children's Institute has been very involved in helping to make the case for expanded investments in Head Start and early Head Start, and we applaud the incredible leadership and steadfastness of this body. The Oregon legislature has been doing all it can in tough times to both invest in high-quality early care and education through those programs and to protect those investments. We know that's critical to moving forward. At the same time, like every other state in the country, we've got a big problem on our hands. On the one hand, we know that the benefits of high-quality early care and education and helping kids catch up and get ready for school. On the other hand, we've got a myriad of programs and investments across agencies, all with different outcomes, evaluation measures. That's not to say those investments aren't important. I want to underscore that. The challenge, though, is we don't have a system. I ask you to imagine what our K-12 system would be like if first, second grade, third, fourth grades all the way to 12 were all housed in different agencies, that we didn't have common assessment or professional development, that in fact parents had to navigate a series of grades in which they can't figure out where the best first grade class or second grade class is for their children. Now, of course, we know there are improvements we want to make in the K-12 system, but still there is a system. Now, in early childhood, we have wonderful programs with research and evidence. You've supported relief nurseries. You've supported child care subsidies. You've supported our home visiting program, which Oregon has looked at nationally for having in all of our counties. The challenge, though, is we don't know how those investments together add up across common assessments, alignment, standards, and evaluation so that you, as a decision-making body, can make those tough resource allocation decisions to figure out how are we doing to prepare children for school. We know at the Children's Institute that having investments are key, but it's not sufficient to know if we're getting the job done. And so the exciting thing about the governor's plan and vision is it begins to take us in that direction of beginning to think about a much more rational system that can be accountable and measurable. Now, there's no question that turning the ship around and creating a system that doesn't exist is a tall order, particularly in the budget climate we're in. But quite frankly, we can't afford to do business as usual because we don't know what we're getting for our investment all told. We know that they're pockets of excellence, and we know that those investments are key. Now, it's clear that we're not going to get there overnight, but what's really important is to identify the doable steps that we can take now and in the 2013 session so that we know over time that we'll have things like a baseline for how all kids are doing at kindergarten and some of those system components that were key to Oregon's very effective plan that was put forward as Race to the Top for the Early Learning Challenge Fund. Oregon came in 13th, which sounds like it wasn't as strong as it was, but 9 were awarded. And Oregon is really well positioned for that second round. And what's in our application are the core system components that would begin to develop this robust early learning system that would then align and connect with the K-12 system, as well as our healthcare investments. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, quick question. Of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your presentation and your articulation of these issues. You completely are in complete command of this subject, clearly. Would you just do me a favor and say a little bit about the Children's Institute?
Sure.
And your background? I know all about it, but Representative Greenlick doesn't know anything about it. So it's
sure. Sure. So we are a research-based organization, and we were actually started by a seed funded by a man named Duncan Campbell, who started another mentoring program, Friends of the Children. And we were really convened by a group of business and philanthropic leaders who felt that the evidence and research was out there, but in fact our private and public investments weren't aligned with what works. So we were created to be a research and action organization. What they did not want to see is report after report. They wanted to know, how can we be a resource to both public and private decision makers about where investments can have the biggest payoff in terms of getting our children ready for school? But really, their view was even longer. What these business leaders were concerned about was workforce preparedness and their understanding that the key to a healthier population and a more educated workforce actually begins prenatally.
Sure.
What I'd like to do is maybe hear from the three of these folks, and then we'll get back to questions. Does that work for people?
Sure.
Thank you.
Again, Duke Shepherd for the record from the governor's office. So you've heard from Swati about our current non-system, and that is the best setup I could have possibly had for this, which is Oregon statute, which is not on the screen, but it looks great on my... So, in statute, we in theory have a system. We have ambitious, fantastic, research-backed, excellent language in statute that has been there for 10 years. We have a 10-year to-do list that we have made almost no progress on. So, when you look at whether it's Children First, Children's Institute, Coalition of Communities of Color, the U.S. Census, the data is pretty clear that we've gone slow for 10 years, and if it's hard to imagine how we could go much slower than not making progress on any of these fine things in statute. So part of the issue in getting those statutory directions achieved is that we have a completely fractured and uncoordinated system at the state level. And as you see here, we have the Commission on Children and Families, Commission on Child Care, the Early Childhood Matters Council, which was appointed by Governor Kulongoski via executive order to meet the requirements of the Head Start Act, and the State Interagency Council, Coordinating Council on our Early Intervention. When you look back at all the statutes, and I've handed out actually all the pages of the ORSs to you, there's nobody in charge, and there's nobody accountable. There is no direction in terms of funding for results. There's no performance expected. It is ambition and intent, but certainly not accountable and certainly not focused on outcomes. So one of the first things that we're trying to do here at the state level is to consolidate this and make sure that someone's holding things accountable. I would point to the Head Start Act, which in fact requires us to have a body that's holding things accountable, and it's the same kind of language we've got in statute in Oregon. This is from 2007 from the Head Start Act reauthorization. And so what
is in our report, the Interim Council's report, and will be in Governor's proposed legislation, is to consolidate the functions related to early learning from the Commission on Children and Families, the Commission for Child Care, and to abolish the executive appointed group and make the Early Learning Council on point for getting things done in Oregon for young children. So this means the State Commission on Children and Families goes away, the Commission on Child Care goes away, the Early Learning Matters, the Early Childhood Matters Committee goes away. You'll see next to the Early Learning Council, a Youth Development Council. I will back up to here. This is because, as you all know, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families does a lot of things, not all of which are related to early learning. They have two subcommittees that deal with juvenile issues. And we have, as with other program areas, a variety of committees, boards, commissions, and programs across government that work with older youth that aren't necessarily connected to the K-12 system. And so it was a recommendation of the commission and these two subcommittees that we have one Youth Development Council that focuses on that continuum and links back to the educational outcome. So that will be
Could
also.
You say what those letters are across
Thank you. I was afraid you would ask me that, Representative Greenlick. Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee and the Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee.
And SICC?
The State Interagency Council on Early Intervention, Early Childhood Education. And the reason I've held that out there is because the legislation that will be before the body coming up proposes no changes to early intervention or early childhood special ed. Instead, it calls for a joint planning process with the Early Learning Council because those services are very complex, very specialized, and not something that should be changed lightly. So that's the state governance approach. The other big change that we're that's come forward through the Early Learning Council and would be in legislation would be to change the state, the county commission system. Right now, you have 36 county commissions on children and families that are established to coordinate and produce plans, but there are not outcomes tied to those dollars. There are not outcomes tied to the system. In their defense, the commission system has been asked to do a lot of different things over the last 20 years, and it changes from session to session. But it's time to refocus that. And so rather than what we've got now, which is a system where there's a formula allocation intended to produce plans that works in some counties better than others, is to open that up to do an RFP process where communities would come together to apply to organize their early childhood services toward the outcomes of getting children ready for school. Now, that RFP may turn out to, in some cases, the county would be the convener still. In some places, it could be a relief nursery, a Head Start program. It really doesn't matter. The difference that we're trying to make here is instead of specifying the structure and the process, that we start specifying the outcomes and turn communities loose to go get it. Now, in this first step of implementation, it would just be streamlining the administrative portion. So we would put a 15% administrative limit on and issue the RFP and not make any changes to any programs over the next year so that no children and families notice any disruption. This should be the behind-the-curtain administrative stuff where we can wring out some savings and efficiencies but also begin to organize things in a way that, as Swati mentioned, we can actually begin to then evaluate where the holes are and what the flaws are and where the places for additional investment should be. Those are the big changes that would be in the legislation. One component from the Race to the Top application that will be in the legislation would direct the Child Care Division to create a tiered quality rating and improvement system for child care settings. And this, for lack of a better comparison, would be like a 4-star rating system for hotels, so that if you are a 1-star, you meet the basic licensure requirements. If you're a 4-star, you're of the highest quality. It is a way to incent quality and improvements in a setting, both in terms of training the workforce and curriculum and the overall quality of the setting, but also to give parents a tool to evaluate the right settings for their children. Everything else in the report and...
Who makes that judgment?
Going forward, who makes the... I'm sorry, Representative Tomei.
You're talking about high quality, not so high quality, et cetera. Who makes that judgment?
So under the legislation, we would direct the Child Care Commission to develop a proposed system and bring that back to the Early Learning Council. There are models out there in the country, and again, this was one component of the Race to the Top grant that we would kind of hope to move forward and position ourselves, frankly, to be successful if there's a second round of Race to the Top funding. Other elements I mentioned earlier, no changes other than the joint planning process around special education. A consistent report back to the legislature, so in the Early Learning Council would report back to your committee, the Education Committee, the appropriate Ways and Means subcommittees in the interim to get ready for next session. The Early Learning Council will be directed to create a new budgeting option for you all to consider so that we look at early learning as a whole, which is inclusive of human services, healthcare, and education, because right now all of those funding decisions get made in a lot of different subcommittees and a lot of different processes, and again, we don't add them up to the outcomes that we want. Finally, it's important to note that there are no changes to Head Start in this legislation. Now, about half of the Head Start slots in the state, Head Start and Early Head Start, are funded by the federal government, and the state of Oregon could not change them if they wanted to. Oregon Pre-K, which is a parallel matched up version of Head Start, tracks with Head Start, is aligned with Head Start in the law, is required to stay that way, locked into what the feds do with Head Start. I will note there are Head Start changes coming, and they are coming from the federal government. They started in 2007 under President Bush, and they're continuing under President Obama. And the most recent example I would use is that Head Start programs will now be required to recompete if deficiencies are found. So there are two programs in Oregon that will be required to recompete. There's no reason to think they wouldn't be successful, but recompetition for Head Start is coming for the first time ever. But again, that's not a state-level decision. And with that,
we're going to hold questions until after Pam.
I'm actually going to be here, Representative, to answer questions.
Oh, terrific.
So in the interest of time, I think we'll stop there.
So I'm assuming we're not going to have any more slideshows. So, yeah, the lights are going up. Terrific. Thank you, Christy. Okay, so I know, yes, Representative, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I have sort of a basic family background in terms of Head Start that is important and early childhood situations. My grandmother started a program in 1950-something or other for the sharecropper kids. As their parents went out into the fields, she had a program for the kids. And in 64, 65, it must have been...
What state?
Missouri. Actually, she started it in Missouri. In 65, Lyndon Johnson asked her to name it Head Start, have to take over that program and call it Head Start instead. So I have a real particular family angst about any things going on there. It is a concern because I've seen good Head Start programs and I have seen very poor Head Start programs. And you can often go to a first grade teacher and they can tell you which one the kids came from. So this is something that is a concern of mine. We have two different Head Start programs in the Portland area, and I've watched them carefully over the last 30 years. So I've seen how those work and how sometimes they haven't worked. I've also seen some of the experts in those programs not being brought into the conversation early enough, quite frankly. And so that's a concern of mine, and I'd like for us to be sure we deal with that. The other aspect is something that is a concern, and we will just take it as a concern. We had the assessment issues regarding how well Head Start is doing, how well young children are doing. It is a concern of mine because we had a real failure take place at the higher levels. And I don't want us to drop into the same kind of multiple choice testing aspect to determine whether kids are failing or not. Not at all interested in that. So if there's a way to avoid that, please note that I'm going to be watching that carefully because I really don't want to have the same kind of assessment problems that we've had with the higher level situations. And finally, one last thing is that one of the problems that we run into is not so much how well the Head Start program is doing, but how they are received, whether they have the same kind of wraparound services once they get into the regular school system. And we can see that failure take place on a regular basis. Kids coming out of Head Start ready to go and then they reach the regular school system, and then they are officially listed as at risk. And that is a phrase that really drives me nuts, just so that you know. The only thing that I've seen is that every kid that I know is at risk if they don't have the support system that they need around them. But they end up being labeled at risk by someone, and they take on that label, whether that is the case or not. So let's see if we can find a way to sustain the incredible activities that Head Start really manages to do. That's my concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I have some figures, and I've just noted some questions I'd like to ask. And so in reading somewhere, there are 40,000 kids born, I think, every year that we would term at risk, and I understand your concern about that phrase. So we're looking at very limited dollars, especially right now. How will you be able, or this plan, be able to target those dollars, target it to the most kids at risk as early as possible? How is that going to happen?
Madam Chair, I'll let Pam jump in as well. I think, first of all, to clarify the number, there are about 45,000 children born in Oregon every year, ranges 45, 47, and about 40% meet some risk factor criteria, whether typically that would be income, but maybe it's exposure to drug and alcohol issues or other circumstances in the home. And so our challenge here is to do precisely what you've asked, and I don't think we quite know how we would do that yet. The initial steps are to better organize what the state does control so that we can then be smarter about making investments, because right now, for example, I couldn't tell you how much money sort of the per unit cost of improved results. I don't know what the bill would be. It's hard to quantify because we have such a fractured system with just a lot of money flowing in a lot of different ways. So the idea here is if we take these initial steps in 2012 to straighten out the governance and performance at the state level, begin to focus on outcomes and accountability and organizing things at a level that then we can go in and really target the investments in a way that we haven't been able to before. But the answer is we don't know yet.
Okay. Fair enough.
Pam is.
Jump in, sure. So, Madam Co-Chair, Pam Curtis from the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at OHSU and Chair of the Early Learning Council. So just to add on one thing that Duke talked about, one of the goals that we have is to identify children who need additional support as early as possible. And to the point that Representative Frederick made, I think the way that we're viewing this is almost like a balance sheet or a balanced ledger sheet. I mean, all kids conceivably have risk factors. All kids conceivably won't tip into needing additional supports if they have certain supports around them. So part of what we want to do is identify kids as early as possible and identify those who may need additional supports because they don't have the supports around them, and offer that opportunity for supports to their families. Some are provided that support for Head Start, for example, that Representative Frederick spoke to. Others need other sorts of supports that we haven't been identifying. So the early assessment and early identification is critical. We also think that it needs to be well-rounded and that we look across five or six domains of child development to identify where kids need that sort of support.
A lot of work to do in a fairly short time. Any other questions? Representative
Greenlee. Madam Chair. Yeah, this Head Start thing is of concern to my constituents as well. I'm getting a lot of contact. When I first got involved starting a Head Start project in 1968, so it's something that's been very much on my mind. There's a saying with the wing walkers, people who in the old days of the biplanes would walk on top of the wings. And their saying for safety was, you never let go with your right hand until you're holding on to something firmly with your left hand. And we need change, there's no question about it. But we need to make sure in the change, I guess it's a statement, not a question, although you may react to it, Duke. We need to make sure that we're keeping what's good at the same time we're getting rid of what is not so good or not so useful to us. And how are you going to assure us that the change is really something that will not destroy things that are good at the same time, or at least not too much of it.
Co-chairs, Representative Greenlee, I think the assurance
I mean, there can only be so much assurance, but I would say, one, you're right, and the governor and the Early Learning Council have the exact same priority of keeping what's working, improving things that need to be improved, and doing the better and new things that need to be done. I think one component is being aggressive about where we want to go, big picture, and being prudent in the steps that we take short term. So that's why we're trying to, for example, take these initial steps that aren't around program delivery and direct services at all, that we really focus on wringing out the administrative part first and then come back and keep the legislature engaged. Frankly, you know, that this doesn't go off into some room somewhere and a bunch of work gets done and then you hear about it 2 years later, that, you know, by coming back and staying engaged and being public and transparent about it, that everybody's held accountable, including the Early Learning Council.
Could you talk some, you're welcome, about the accountability hubs? I'm referring to your report we've gotten earlier. Talk some about that. That's hard for me to grasp.
Sure. Chair Tomei, and I'll defer to Pam as well. One, I'll tell you, I think we got the term hubs from the Oregon Community Foundation, which has done and continues to do work around parent education. And they did an RFP for communities to organize themselves to be parent education hubs. And I think it is somewhat notable that what they didn't do was just write a check to the existing system and say, you're the right people to go do it. So, again, a concrete example of investors who care about outcomes not having confidence in what we've got in the state already. The idea actually harkens back a little bit to what the idea was for Commissions on Children and Families. I think it's partly the convener. It is the local organizing of disparate programs and, in some cases, both state-funded, county-funded, locally-funded, federally-funded into a local system. The idea being that there has to be somebody who is accountable for the state dollars, and it can't be just the state bureaucracy that kind of checks in on a bunch of different programs every once in a while and sees how it's going. It should be a locally reinforced discussion about how results are getting done and how the money's being spent. But the accountability, there has to be a single point of accountability for the state dollars. And initially, with these commission funds, that would be, instead of 36 commissions, we would have, the numbers I have used are between 5 and 36, because we want this to be open. On the other hand, it simply doesn't make sense to fund 36 separate infrastructures of staff and executive directors across the state when you have, in some communities, Head Start, Community Action, Relief Nurseries, all with executive directors, all with program staff, all with really smart people who are doing this, who could organize this if given the opportunity. And so the idea is that we would challenge and make the opportunity available to pursue these outcomes and tie the dollars to organizing your community in a way that gets to those outcomes.
And you're planning to do this in 5 months? Is that what I understand, by July 1st?
So that is what is in the report. That is what will come out in the Madam Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam. That is what is in the report. That's what will come out in the ELC draft. I will tell you, I am working on amendments right now that would bump this out a year and provide an incentive for early innovators and early adopters, but not require the RFP for a year. The counties have raised this, and it's a perfectly valid concern about transition time. And this gets back to Representative Greenlick's question. You know, change is good, and speed is ideal given our history, but we got to be smart about it.
Okay. I have more questions, but I'm going to open it up to other people. I don't want to harp. Yes. Any other questions? Mrs. Harker, I'm depending on you. So talk about the tiers. I was reading about the tiers. Help me understand that.
Can you spell that?
T-I-E-R-S. Thank you. Shedding tears.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, for the T-Q-R-I-S.
T-I-E-R-S, didn't I read
tiers?
That?
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I can. So, Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, the tiers, just to clarify, meaning the TQRS, the tiers, the rating tiers in terms of childcare?
Right.
Okay.
Thank you. So Oregon has made some progress toward this already with approvals that you have made in previous budget years, but we are one of the states across the nation that does not have a TQ, I can't get the letters always right either, the TQRIS in place, although it was one of the things that was required in the Race to the Top application by the federal government and will be continued to be incented by them through their child care work at the federal level. Essentially, the idea is, I think Duke's illustration is an apt one, that we would have the sort of transparency and informed choice available to our parent community as would be available if you were going to a restaurant or going to a hotel and you wanted or a consumer, you looked up something in a consumer's report guide to learn what the basic components of that particular program are when you're choosing that for your child. And we would have a tiered rating system that would have a very basic level, which is probably meeting, although it hasn't been developed yet, but in other states, the basic level is meeting basic health and safety standards, and then it sort of, and then it goes up from there in terms of those programs' ability to meet standards, those programs' ability to achieve outcomes, those programs' ability to help children get ready to learn when they enter school. So we see this as as something that would assist in increasing the transparency and the choices available to parents so that they could make informed choices, but also serve as an opportunity that would sort of light the path for programs who wanted to increase their own quality and could serve to match up with the professional development system that we're putting in place or is already in place at Portland State University for child care workers.
Thank you. Christy, did she identify herself? Okay, could you please do that, Pam?
Yes, you bet. For the record, Pam Curtis. I'm the Deputy Director at the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at OHSU and Chair of the Early Learning Council.
Thank you. Any further questions? Let me look and see if I have any more of my own. Are you going to be working with ERDC at all? Is that the employment-related daycare, is that going to be an issue in this program?
Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Gilliam, yes.
Could you talk some about that, please?
I guess I can only talk about it in the sense that we are trying to ensuring that we actually have a system that if there are state funds going to support children in child care settings or state funds that across various agencies that are intended to prepare children for school, that we want them to be a part of the system. But beyond that, there's not sort of a specific, this is the ERDC plan.
Okay.
It's just that it's part of what happens.
Okay. Any further questions? Colleagues, this is a huge program. They're trying to put it together in a very short time. This is the committee where this is going to be dealt with. So I think we're just, at least speaking for myself, I'm only just beginning to understand what this is. I think we will be, as we learn more, we're going to be having more questions. And we certainly want to support this. I think the concept is wonderful. And I think your idea of looking at it as we do education K through 12, you don't have to go to find the best second grade teacher and the best third grade teacher and what school my kid should be going to. There is some continuum. And I think that is a great concept. And I'm glad to hear that you're going to perhaps put it out for another year because I can't imagine how all of this could be accomplished in 5 months. So please keep us informed and please come back. When you feel like you're at a point that you have more information to give us, please let us know. And at some point that we have more questions, we will let you know. Because it is a very important program and we want to support it. We want to make sure that it's successful. One last thing I guess I want to comment on, and I think I don't dislike the idea of we don't need 36 counties doing similar kinds of things. But I would think that the counties, and especially the counties that have very active commissions on children and families, we'll have some definite opinions around this issue. And I think we're going to need help from you if you're wanting us to support this and helping us understand that so we can bring this back to our counties and to other people who are representing other counties.
Madam Chair, I would just say the counties have been enormously helpful in providing feedback on the direction that we're taking. A lot of their recommendations were included in the report and have influenced the direction of the legislation. And I think if this RFP process works out the way we would hope, I would anticipate that there will be several commissions that would be the competitors and would be successful, because there are some who do, who are doing exactly what we're talking about already.
That's great.
I'm glad you, if I might.
You might.
I might. I'm glad you said that, and I appreciate that response. To the extent that this would improve the services in counties, I mean, county government is a difficult, difficult thing because we're all so different. Then I'm excited to hear more. But Chair Tomei and I represent, she represents more of Clackamas County than I do, but I represent parts of Clackamas County, and I represent a lot of Marion County. And there's two commissions that are doing really good work. And so, of course, my concern is that we don't disrupt those who are doing well, which is why I appreciate your answer. And if the reorganization helps us in areas that aren't being served very well, not through any fault of their commissions, but just simply because of the geography, the resources, and so forth, then this is interesting. But I'll stick with my wing walker down there and say, you know, we want to be sure that I'm much too young to know what he was talking about, but we want to be sure before we make, change is always hard, but we want to be sure we're not putting anybody at risk when we move forward with something as ambitious as this.
I see other people in the audience too, and I would imagine a lot of you are here because you have questions too, so I hope you will filter those into our committee so that we can deal with those. You have a hard job ahead of you, and an admirable job. Thank you so much for working on this. Any last questions before we let these people go? And let us know how we can help you in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We
hope to be back soon.
Thank you. With that, I will close the informational hearing on the Early Learning Council. And okay, we'll open up the work session on what?
On introduction of measures.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 96, dated December 12, 2011. LC 108, dated January 12, 2012. LC 256, dated January 19, 2012. LC 259, dated January 19th, 2012.
Co-chair, you switched. Oh, I was supposed to do that part, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, no, it's fine. I just take two. Chair Tomei moves that LCs 96, 108, 256, and 259 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Do it. I thought you were going to do all four of them.
Didn't I just do all four of them?
He did. Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Do you want me to make a record about the draft that was distributed with today?
Yes. And one of the comments I'd like for our clerk to make is, I should say our administrator to make, is the clarification on LC 256.
And 259. The chairs and members, you may have noticed the activity of staff during the last panel, and I wanted to apologize if there was any distraction to those folks. We were informed last night by Legislative Council's office that these two drafts needed a change in the relating to clause. And we were prepared today to retreat to a previous version of those bills with the correct clause, if needed, because they weren't certain they could produce these by the end of today's hearing. That is the only change between the draft dated the 18th, which is yesterday, and the draft dated today, the 19th. There may be, as I understand, a couple of two technical changes as well, nothing substantive. But the primary importance, as you all know, the relating to clause can't be changed after introductions, but further edits could be made if needed. So LC comes through in the final hour in ways that we rarely thank them for enough, and they were able to deliver these, and we prepared the proper bill backs with the correct date and the correct relating to clause, and that's the, we have the hard copy, we have
staff putting it on the S Drive and posting it to the web during the hearing to cover the bases and make sure you had the most recent version with the correct clause.
Thank you. So I think we are in order. And any other questions about that or comments? Then it's important that we review each time, and I didn't do it, that the qualifier. We've all heard it, but I'm going to make sure it's on record.
Yes.
And that is a vote in favor here today of merely introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position about the content.
So a no vote doesn't mean that you're necessarily opposed to it?
Right.
You're nothing but trouble, Wayne Walker. So the qualifier has been read and clarified. So I will ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Greenland.
Yes.
Representative Parker.
Yes.
Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Representative Wagner.
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson.
Excused.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Co-Chair Tomei.
Aye.
The motion passes, and the measures are introduced as committee bills for our committee.
Close the work session, and this is the last interim.
I'll close our work session on the introduction of committee measures. And unless there are other comments for the good of this unbelievable committee, would you all say a prayer for Representative Thompson's first floor that's flooding at the moment? That's why he left us.
Oh, my.
And I'm very sorry that happened.
The floor is flooding.
Yes. Did you hear about Sarah last night?
And so, there's nobody that wants to confess their skinny dipping. I'm going to close the committee on
every morning.
House Human Services.
Thank you.